Charity thought of the credit cards and of the Wurlitzer jukebox Holly's husband had been able to afford but did not know how to fix. Those were the things that had impressed Brett, and she supposed they had impressed her as well in some way. Perhaps she had seen them through Brett's eyes a little, through Joe's eyes, and enough was enough. "Yes," she said, "I guess I've done my visiting. I'll tell Holly this morning." "Okay, Mom." He looked at her a little shyly. "I wouldn't mind coming back, you know. I do like them. And he's a neat little kid. Maybe he can come up to Maine sometime." "Yes," she said, surprised and grateful. She didn't think Joe would object to that. "Yes, maybe that could be arranged." "Okay. And tell me what Mr. Thornton said." "I will." But Alva never called back. As he was feeding his chickens that morning, the motor in his big air conditioner blew, and he was immediately in a life-or-death struggle to save his birds before the day's heat could kill them. Donna Trenton might have called it another stroke of that same fate she saw reflected in Cujo's muddy, homicidal eyes. By the time the issue of the air conditioner was settled, it was 4 p.m. Alva Thornton lost 62 chickens that day and counted himself off cheaply. And the confrontation, which had begun Monday afternoon in the Cambers' sun-struck dooryard, was over. Andy Mason was the Maine Attorney General's wunderkind, and there were those who said that someday, and not too distant a day either, he would lead the AG's criminal division. Andy Mason's sights were set a good deal higher than that. He hoped to be Attorney General himself in 1984, and in a position to run for governor by 1987. And after 8 years as governor, who knew? He came from a large, poor family. He and his 3 brothers and 2 sisters had grown up in a ramshackle, poor white trash house on the outer Sabbatus Road in the town of Lisbon. His brothers and sisters had been exactly up or down to town expectations. Only Andy Mason and his youngest brother Marty had managed to finish high school. For a while it had looked as if Roberta might make it, but she had gotten herself knocked up higher than a kite following a dance her senior year. She had left school to marry the boy, who still had pimples at 29, drank Narragansett straight from the can, and knocked both her and the kid around. Marty had been killed in a car crash over on Route 9 in Durham. He and some of his drunk friends had tried to take the tight curve up Siroyas Hill at 70. The Camaro in which they were riding rolled over twice and burned. Andy had been the star of the family, but his mother had never liked him. She was a little afraid of him. When talking to friends, she would say, "My Andy's a cold fish." But he was more than that. He was always tightly controlled, always buttoned up. He knew from the 5th grade on that he was going to somehow get through college and become a lawyer. Lawyers made a lot of money. Lawyers worked with logic. Logic was Andy's god. He saw each event as a point from which a finite number of possibilities radiated. At the end of each possibility line was another event point, and so on. This point-to-point blueprint of life had served him very well. He made straight A's through grammar school and high school, got a merit scholarship, and could have gone to college almost anywhere. He decided on the University of Maine, throwing away his chance at Harvard because he had already decided to start his career in Augusta, and he didn't want some piney woodser in gum-rubber boots and a lumberman's jacket throwing Harvard in his face. On this hot July morning, things were right on schedule. He put Vic Trenton's phone down. There had been no answer at the Camber telephone number. The state police detective and Bannerman were still here waiting for instructions like well-trained dogs. He had worked with Townsend, the state police guy, before, and he was the sort of fellow Andy Mason felt comfortable with when you said, "Fetch," Townsend fetched. Bannerman was a new one, and Mason didn't care for him. His eyes were a little too bright, and the way he had suddenly come out with the idea that Kemp might have coerced the woman by using the kid. Well, such ideas, if they were going to come, ought to come from Andy Mason. The 3 of them sat on the sectional sofa, not talking, just drinking coffee and waiting for the FBI guys to show up with the traceback equipment. Andy thought about the case. It might be a tempest in a teapot, but it might well be something more. The husband was convinced it was a kidnapping and attached no importance to the missing car. He was fixated on the idea that Stephen Kemp had taken his people. Andy Mason was not so sure. Camber wasn't home. No one was home up there. Maybe they had all gone on vacation. That was likely enough. July was the quintessential vacation month, and they had been due to hit someone who was gone. Would he have taken her car in for a repair job if he was going away? Unlikely. Unlikely that the car was there at all, but it had to be checked. And there was one possibility he had neglected to mention to Vic. Suppose she had taken the car up to Camber's garage. Suppose someone had offered her a lift back, not a friend, not an acquaintance, not Camber or his wife, but a total stranger. Andy could hear Trenton saying, "Oh, no, my wife would never accept a ride from a stranger." But in the vernacular, she had accepted several rides from Steve Kemp, who was almost a stranger. If the hypothetical man was friendly, and if she was anxious to get her son home, she might have accepted. And maybe the nice, smiling man was some kind of a freak. They had had just such a freak here in Castle Rock before. Frank Dodd. Maybe the nice, smiling man had left them in the brush with their throats cut and had hied on his merry way. If that was the case, the Pinto would be at Camber's. Andy did not think this line of reasoning likely, but it was possible. He would have sent a man up to the Camber's anyway. It was routine. But he liked to understand why he was doing each thing he was doing. He thought that for all practical purposes, he could dismiss Camber's garage from the structure of logic and order he was building. He supposed she could have gone up there, discovered the Cambers were gone, and then had her car conk out on her. But Castle Rock's town road number 3 was hardly Antarctica. She and the kid had only to walk to the nearest house and ask to use the phone in that case, but they hadn't done it. "Mr. Townsend," he said in his soft voice, "you and Sheriff Bannerman here ought to take a ride out to this Joe Camber's garage. Verify 3 things. No blue Pinto there. License number 218-864. No Donna and Theodore Trenton there. No Camber's there. Got that?" "Fine," Townsend said. "Do you want?"
"I want only those 3 things," Andy said softly.
He didn't like the way Bannerman was looking at him with a kind of weary contempt. It upset him. "If any of those 3 are there, call me here, and if I'm not here, I'll leave a number. Understood?" The telephone rang. Bannerman picked it up, listened, and offered it to Andy Mason. "For you, hotshot." Their eyes locked over the telephone. Mason thought that Bannerman would drop his, but he didn't. After a moment, Andy took the phone. The call was from the state police barracks in Scarborough. Steve Kemp had been picked up. His van had been spotted in the courtyard of a small motel in the Massachusetts town of Twickenham. The woman and the boy were not with him. After receiving the Miranda, Kemp had given his name and had since been standing on his right to remain silent. Andy Mason found that extremely ominous news. "Townsend, you come with me," he said. "You can handle the Camber place by yourself, can't you, Sheriff Bannerman?" "It's my town," Bannerman said. Andy Mason lit a cigarette and looked at Bannerman through the shifting smoke. "Have you got a problem with me, Sheriff?" Bannerman smiled. "Nothing I can't handle." "Christ, I hate these hicks," Mason thought, watching Bannerman leave. "But he's out of the play now, anyway. Thank God for small favors." Bannerman got behind the wheel of his cruiser, fired it up, and backed out of the Trenton driveway. It was 7:20. He was almost amused at how neatly Mason had shunted him off onto a siding. They were headed toward the heart of the matter. He was headed nowhere. But old Hank Townsend was going to have to listen to a whole morning's worth of Mason's bullshit. So maybe he had gotten off well at that. George Bannerman loafed out Route 117 toward the Maple Sugar Road, siren and flashers off. It surely was a pretty day, and he saw no need to hurry. Donna and Tad Trenton were sleeping. Their positions were very similar, the awkward sleeping positions of those forced to spend long hours on interstate buses. Their heads lolled against the sockets of their shoulders. Donna's turned to the left, Tad's to the right. Tad's hands lay in his lap like beached fish. Now and again they would twitch. His breathing was harsh and stertorous. His lips were blistered, his eyelids a purplish color.